Okay, we are wrapping up the book of Ruth this morning, and because inquiring minds want to know what's next, I'm going to guess. Rocky and I's schedules put us out of touch for the next 2 to 3 weeks in the sense that we may or may not be around, and so we have a substitute teacher. Dr. Fred Shea is going to come over and teach for the next 3 Sundays. So he'll take next Sunday and the first 2 Sundays in September. And then starting on about the 16th, I think that's the right date, Rocky and I are going to start a series in systematic theology. That sounds impressive, doesn't it? We're going to do stuff on the character of God, the Trinity, demonology, the angelic conflict, and the Abrahamic and Mosaic and the New Covenant. So that's kind of a broad brushstroke stuff that we're going to do. At least that's what this piece of paper says that Rocky sent me. So, but you can pray for us as we put those thoughts together and prepare for what's next. We haven't done that in a while in terms of just topical, systematic stuff. We also have thrown a couple of panels in there into our schedule. So there may be a couple of Sundays where there are supposed experts sitting up here in the front, and you get to ask questions to stump the experts. I may or may not be a part of that, but we'll see how all that goes. Once upon a time, in a far-off country, there was a girl. She lived with her stepmother and her 2 stepsisters. Her stepmother made her work very hard. Her stepsisters mocked her. One day, a letter came announcing that the king was giving a ball where his son, Prince Charming, would pick a wife, and all the eligible girls in the kingdom were invited. And you know the rest of the story. And who doesn't like a Cinderella story? Problem is, Cinderella stories are fantasy stories. Real life's not like Cinderella. Things don't happen that way. For the most part, we live very ordinary lives. We make our decisions and we make our plans, and they seem to have very little connection to anyone or anything outside of our own immediate family and perhaps friends and church. As believers, we know that God is in control, but it's often very difficult to see what difference our lives make in the bigger picture of his providence and what he's doing. Well, when you get to that place and you start thinking that way, go to Ruth chapter 4. John Piper gives an incredible summary of the book of Ruth, and I want to start with this summary this morning. He said, the book of Ruth wants to teach us that God's purpose for the life of his people is to connect us to something far greater than ourselves. God wants us to know that when we follow him, our lives always mean more than they think, though more than we think they do. For the Christian, there's always a connection between the ordinary events of life and the stupendous work of God in history. Everything we do in obedience to God, no matter how small, is significant. It's part of a cosmic mosaic which God is painting to display the greatness of his power and wisdom to the world and to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. The deep satisfaction of the Christian life is that it is not given over to trifles. Serving a widowed mother-in-law, gleaning in a field, falling in love, having a baby. For the Christian, these things are all connected to eternity. They are part of something so much bigger than they seem. And we'll see that played out in chapter 4 of the book of Ruth. We ended chapter 3 with Ruth doing what's often hard for us to do, waiting. She'd made plans based on what many would say were chance occurrences in life, proceeded back to advice from her mother-in-law, going back to decisions that were made by the family in chapter 1. So how's it all going to end? How it all will it work out? Will it work out? Ruth chapter 4, Boaz went up to the gate from the threshing floor, and he sat down. And behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by. So he said, turn aside, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. The gate is the center of city life. It's the place where the elders and leaders of the city met, the place where legal connections took place, where contracts were validated, where trade agreements were made, and where business and civic affairs were transacted. It was at the city gate where Abraham negotiated to buy the cave of Machpelah from Ephraim. And there are a number of verses that I listed for you in their outline of other places where the city gate was important. The gate was the place where counsel was sought, where discussion took place and decisions were made. The decisions that were decided on at the city gate were binding. Just take a little rabbit trail for a minute. When you think about that information, put that statement that Jesus made in Matthew chapter 16 and verse 18, where he said, I'll build my church, and the gates of hell, the decisions, plans, and counsel of Satan will not overpower his church. So it gives you a little context to a statement that Jesus made out of the cultural understanding of the city gate. So Boaz arrives at the city gate. He sits down, and it just so happens, another coincidence in the book of Ruth, right, that the closer relative is passing by. One of the fascinating aspects of this is that the author of the book of Ruth never gives the name of this closer relative. Matter of fact, the specific phrase that's used here, friend is not really, New American Standard translates it friend, that's not a good translation. It's really so-and-so, such-and-such, a certain one. It's the Hebrew poloni almoni. Just means a certain one. His name is left out of this whole story. And again, when you stop and think about it, names are incredibly important to the nation of Israel, and names are incredibly important in the book of Ruth. Everybody gets a name. Even the sons who died got a name. But the closer relative gets no name. He just passes off the scene of history. But Boaz invites the man to sit down, and he calls together 10 elders. Again, whether it was the custom to call 10, the law doesn't specify 10. Perhaps that was the custom. But their presence would certainly put some pressure on the individual to render a decision, and the decision would therefore be witnessed and binding. So Boaz unfolds the events in this case-by-case or this step-by-step case. Having invited the closer relative to sit down, he says, verse 3, Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. So first of all, he says, there's land that needs to be purchased. Secondly, he says, I sought to inform you, verse 4, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you'll not do it, I'll do it. But if not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you. So Boaz says to him, you're the closer relative, and this land needs to be redeemed, and you need to decide what your responsibility is. And if you don't want to do it, can't do it, I'll take responsibility. Now you need to pause just for a moment, because it's the first time in the book of Ruth that there's any mention that Naomi owns anything. Remember what she said when she returned at the end of chapter 1? I have come back empty. Now obviously she's referring to the loss of her husband and the loss of her sons, but she's also referring to the loss of any possessions. She says, I've come back and I don't have anything. So what's the deal with the land? We don't know. But let me give you an educated guess or two to think about. Again, it's not so much that she has land to sell, that is, she owns something. Our culture, we own things and we sell them. You can buy stuff on eBay from somebody that wants to sell something. You can buy stuff on Craigslist from somebody that wants to sell something. They own it and you want it and you can buy it. It's not that she owned the land to sell. The land had been lost or previously sold by her husband Elimelech, and therefore it was in the family line, and it needed to be more redeemed, bought back, than sold. So we have this field formerly belonging to Elimelech, which now can be bought back into his family by a closer relative. Now, we know nothing about that previously. It's not mentioned. It just mentions we begin the book of Ruth where there was a famine in the land and they left. Well, if you owned land and you were leaving because of a famine, what would you do with your land? Well, if you could find somebody who was crazy enough to buy it, you'd sell it. And that's certainly a logical possibility in terms of what happened to the land as Elimelech and Naomi and their sons were leaving in order to finance their trip. He sold the property. Remember, the book of Ruth began with the fact that they were going to sojourn in Moab. And the word sojourn means to set up residence for a unspecified period of time, i.e., it was not a two-week vacation. They were going to Moab to live there for a period of time. And perhaps in Elimelech's mind, what's the point of having land in the midst of a famine that has no value to me when I'm going to another country? So very possibly, he either left it or he sold it. But you know from what we've talked about before that the land was specifically designed to stay in the family. And that's why we have the kinsman redeemer who's going to repurchase the land, redeem it, and bring it back to the family so that Naomi can have the means to take care of her family. So what's the kinsman's responsibility to buy back the land? What does his closer relative say when Boaz lays out the scenario, here's the land, and you're the closer relative? I'll do it. Isn't that what he says at the end of verse 4? I will redeem the land. Sounds like a good idea. I'll have more land. It'll produce more. It'll make more money, and I'll have a greater inheritance. Then Boaz says, oh, by the way, there's an addendum to this proposition. On the day you buy the land from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. If you were here last week, you remember when we talked about the Levirate marriage and we talked about the kinsman redeemer. The kinsman redeemer's responsibility was to redeem property or redeem a person who had been sold into slavery, right? He was not required, as a kinsman redeemer, to marry anyone. And Naomi had no relatives. She only had a daughter-in-law. Boaz seems to imply, or does imply, that there's a not legal obligation, but a moral obligation on the part of the kinsman redeemer in order to buy the land, to provide for the family, to produce a family, a physical family through Ruth. So if you're going to purchase the land, which is in Naomi's name, Elimelech's name, family property, and Ruth is the only long-living relative who can bear children, your responsibility to marry Ruth is there as well. Now, that throws a whole kink in the thinking process of the closer relative. I mean, look at it this way. If the thought of a marriageable widow was associated with the land, even crossed the kinsman's mind, he probably assumed it would be Naomi. She was too far advanced in years to bear children. She posed no threat to his prospective profitable purchase. The alluring proposition offered him double returns for his small investment. He not only increased the size of his own holdings, but he'd enhance his civic reputation as one loyal to his family. future profits from the land would offset any expenses incurred in caring for Naomi. Indeed, given her difficult life, one might not expect her to live much longer anyway. In any case, there was no risk of losing his investment to the claims of a future heir. However, a required marriage to Ruth is a whole different matter. She's younger. She might bear several sons. The first eligible to claim Elimelech's property as his heir, others perhaps to share in the kinsman's own inheritance. That possibility made the investment all too risky. The profit to be turned would be his only until the child acquired Elimelech's land, probably on attaining adulthood. Further, the care of a younger wife meant considerable more expense than anticipated. Hence, he willingly waives his right as redeemer. Notice what he says. The closest relative says in verse 6, I cannot redeem it for myself. He doesn't say, I will not. He says, I cannot because I would jeopardize my own inheritance. One of the things this tells us, as an aside, is that the responsibility of the Goel, the kinsman redeemer, is that his responsibility could involve great cost and great personal sacrifice. He's going to have to put out his own money to purchase the land, to redeem it. Then he's going to have to bear the cost of the marriage. Then he's going to have to bear the cost of the sacrifice of raising a family. Then he's going to have to bear the fact that the land is actually going to revert to another. Ruth's son will get the land eventually when he becomes an adult. The kinsman decides that this is beyond his ability. I can't. I really don't think that this is about the heart of the closer relative being unwilling, that he's a bad close relative. I personally think, based on the way that Boaz treated him and the way that the closer relative responded, is that he evaluated the situation and he says, I can't do it. I don't have the resources to purchase the land and raise a family and then give it away. He may have been the closer relative, and maybe he only had a really small portion of land. And he could potentially lose all of it. And his sons that he had would get nothing because it might all go potentially to Ruth and her sons. And so I really think it's kind of like there are times when someone comes and says, you know, you see the new commercial and you already have a 50-inch screen, but you need the 70-inch screen. And this would make the, you know, football bigger and clearer and sharper. And so you need this one. But you look at what money's in the bank and go, I may need that, but I literally can't afford it. And your wife reminds you that you shouldn't put it on your credit card either. So you can't get it. You'd like to have it, and it's available, but you can't. It's not about your heart. It's about your ability. And I think that's the issue with the closer kinsman. It's about his inability. So in the custom of the day, the closer relative says to Boaz, buy it for yourself, and he removes his sandal and gives it to him. Guy, don't you want to possess somebody else's shoes? Isn't that one of your greatest desires? You know, I want to wear, and if they're sandals, then that means they've really got, there's no sock covering on them. So you've got his feet, germs, all in those sandals and all the dirt, and he gives you his sandal. What's going on here with the purpose of the sandal? Again, there's no historical record in Scripture about the removing of a sandal outside of other related issues in terms of it's holy ground, take off your shoes kind of thing to Moses. But perhaps, according to the custom of the day, the removal of the sandal signifies the transaction of the sale of land, because God often says to his people, he said it to Abraham, he said it to Joshua, every place where your foot treads, shall be yours. You know, God's promise to his people that where they go, you will own this. This will be your land. So the closer relative is saying the land, the land that belongs, the further I get away, the more that thing beeps. Are we better? Okay, we'll try again. The land on which my foot has trod, would have trod had I purchased it, I'm relinquishing the right and I'm giving it to you. And you have the possession, you have the sandal that says, I'm not going to redeem the land, I'm giving you the right to redeem the land. And all the elders who are there, the 10 of them, witness this process. And the text reminds us, it says in verse, he removed us that Boaz said to the elders, verse 9, you're witnesses today. I've bought the land from the hand of Naomi, all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Moreover, I've acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance, so the name of the deceased will not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today. Boaz has dealt honorably with the closest relative, and he calls the witnesses forward and says, you witness now that I am accepting the responsibility of taking on both the land, redeeming it, and marrying Ruth. And my purpose, says Boaz, is to raise up a name for the deceased. Boaz's emphasis on raising up a name, particularly Mahlon, Ruth's former husband, and Elimelech, shows Boaz's concern and his commitment to both the tradition and the requirements of the law to raise up an inheritance, a family, so that the widow could be cared for. But it's not her name, it's the husband's name. And it's the husband's son's name, Ruth's former husband. By the way, this is the only text in where we learn that Ruth was married to Mahlon, not Chilion. It's the only place in the book of Ruth where it's stated who she was married to. That's an aside, so you know that. But he wants to raise up a family. It's not so much just that he wants to marry Ruth. It's not so much that he just wants to redeem the land. He has a bigger picture in mind of where he's going and what he wants to accomplish. The elders, then, and the people who are in the court who have witnessed all of this, it says in verse 11, all the people who are in the court and the elders said, that's right, we are witnesses. We've seen the heard the conversation, we've seen the transaction, and we are in agreement. And from now on to the rest of this chapter, it's basically a pronouncement of blessings. It's a blessing that these elders and people who are in the city gate give to Boaz. And then there's the blessing that the women will give to Naomi. And it's all about prayers and blessings. Notice how this is laid out. All the people in the city gate and the elders give the approval of Boaz's plan. They accept their responsibility as witnesses. And they begin to pray or bless, ask a blessing upon. May the Lord, verse 11 in the middle of the verse, may the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. Out of Rachel and Leah come the tribes of Israel, basically. They're the beginning. And from them come a large group of folks. And so basically they're praying that Ruth would have a big family. That's what they're at. That, and that her heritage would look like these women that are held in high esteem in the nation. So they're asking a blessing upon Ruth. Then they're praying for a blessing upon Boaz. Notice the end of verse 11. That you may achieve wealth in Ephratah and become famous in Bethlehem. And the word wealth is the same word that we looked at last week, chalil, which could be translated character, which could be translated to be well. May it go well with you. Not just in terms of how much you possess materially, but how much you possess in terms of integrity. You're standing in the community. It was mentioned in chapter 3 where the folks of the town in Bethlehem recognized that Ruth was a woman of excellence. Chayil. She's a woman of character and good standing. And so they're praying that Boaz would have good standing in Bethlehem. That his name would be well known throughout the history of the city of Bethlehem. Who knew? As they prayed that, what literally was going to happen? Do you think that as they prayed that prayer for Boaz, they were thinking, oh, he's going to give birth to a son. His son will give birth to another son, and that son, and they give birth to another son, and he'll become the greatest king for the nation of Israel. Do you think that's what was in their mind when they prayed that? No. But God was at work in the midst of this, doing something way beyond where they were at the moment. And so then they pray, thirdly, for the family. Look at verse 12. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah through the offspring which the Lord will give you by this young woman. Again, it's fascinating to me that another Gentile woman gets mentioned in the book of Ruth. Ruth being a Moabite. It's Tamar being the Canaanite woman, and we looked at her before. Through her came Perez, who became literally the ancestor of most of the Bethlehemites. You can find this in 1 Chronicles chapter 2, because it says Perez to Hezron to Caleb to Ephratah, the Bethlehemites. And Perez was generally regarded as an outstanding example of, for lack of a better way to put it, fruitfulness. So again, they're praying for a large family. May Ruth conceive. May your family be large. May your name be well spoken of. Ruth and Boaz are married at last. Verse 13, she became his wife. He went into her. The Lord enabled her to conceive. She gave birth to a son. Remember, she'd been married before, perhaps for up to 10 years, without being able to give birth. Now, God enables her to conceive. And she gives birth. Again, a reminder that all life is a gift from God, and it's in His timing, and you see God's hand in the midst of all of this. And then the woman say to Naomi, so the scene switches, if you will. We've gone from the city gate, we've had a wedding, and now it's almost like this is the reception. Okay? The women say to Naomi, verse 14, blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today. And may his name become famous in Israel. May he also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. Remember when Naomi returned from Moab, her perspective that she spoke to the women of the town of Bethlehem was, I've come back empty. Do not call me Naomi, verse 20 of chapter 1, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord is witness against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? Woe is me. I've got nothing. To whom had she spoken those words? If you look at the end of verse 19, because of the women who said, is this Naomi? And Naomi spoke this to a group of women. Can I suggest to you that perhaps some of the same women that offered the blessing in chapter 4 were the same women that heard the pronouncement of woe is me in chapter 1? She's returned empty and bitter. Now her life is blessed and full. The Lord has brought her back even in her bitterness and has provided a redeemer and a son. Because even though from Naomi's perspective her life was the pits, God was moving in those circumstances to bring about his plan. So the women pray that the son would be famous. That is, his name would be perpetuated. When you'd hear it, you'd think well of it. That not just in being known as a person, but being known as a person of integrity, as a man of God, he would have character and virtue and service. And that this man, the son, would be a provider and a nourisher for Naomi as she ages. That is, Elimelech's line will be carried on in land that belongs to the family. So Ruth and Naomi are given a future and a hope. Fascinating little phrase at the end where it says, Ruth is better to you than seven sons. What was significant to any family in the nation of Israel was to have sons. And the more sons you had, the better. And seven is that sense of complete number. And so if you have seven sons, then you're incredibly blessed. And so these women are saying, Ruth is better to you than to have had seven sons of your own. That's how much she has cared for you and honored you and respects you and has provided for you. They're basically recognizing in words what Boaz says they already knew in their heart. For in chapter 3 and verse 11, it says, for all the people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence, a woman of character, integrity, and honor. And so these women actually pronounce that blessing in chapter 4. Here's Ruth. She's better to you than seven sons. And they not only bless Ruth and Naomi, but their interest turns to the child. It says, Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, became his nurse, his caregiver, and the neighbor women gave him a name. Imagine that. The women gave him a name. Ruth didn't name him. Naomi didn't name him. They had a committee meeting. Well, what do you think? Did you ever do that in your family? What do you think? What name would you like to have? We got to give suggestions when Jen was pregnant with our grandson, Ari. She's pregnant again. We don't give suggestions because they already told us what her name is. So, but the local town, these women are so close to Naomi that they actually give the name to the child and they name him Obed, which means servant. And then the verse ends, Obed is the father of Jesse, who's the father of David. A son, a servant, and ultimately the seed for the messianic line. See, the story of Ruth and Naomi and Boaz doesn't end with the birth of Obed. It simply signifies the ongoing history, the ongoing story of what God is doing that will lead directly to the birth of David, which ultimately leads to the birth of Messiah. Who would have thought, had you been there and experienced those events and walked in their shoes, that the marriage of Boaz and a Moabite woman who had converted to Judaism, had made her commitment to Yahweh, that marriage would lead to Israel's greatest king? Rob.
In verse 14, blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a word, may his name be famous in Israel. May his name, his being the Lord, being Obed, or being Boaz?
I think it's Obed. May his name. Because the reference is, the Lord has not left you without a redeemer. Specifically Boaz. And so it could be him, but I think because the bigger context is the son, the seed that has come, that it's Obed. That's just a personal opinion. And I think you could do it. Obviously, it could be the Lord. The Lord's name should be famous because he's the one that's provided. He's the Redeemer, ultimately.
But the Hebrew grammar doesn't.
Not to my knowledge, but again, I'm not the Hebrew scholar either. So,
Elimelech is perpetuated because their kinsman redeemer does what the kinsman redeemer does for it. It's perpetuated, but Boaz still gets credit in the genealogy.
Yeah.
As Boaz.
As Boaz. Not Elimelech. Yeah.
That's
the family name.
Is that just sort of, his name continues, the land stays where it was supposed to stay, but by golly, we're given the guy who made the decision, the bread of the headlines.
Right, yeah, and I think because, again, that goes back to the prayer that was made by the elders, that may Ruth be blessed, you be blessed, the child be blessed, the family, so that there is a connection to Boaz, who has dealt very honorably throughout this whole story, how he's treated Ruth, how he's provided both in the gleaning and how he treated her when she showed up at the threshing floor, how he's dealt with the nearest kinsman. I mean, Boaz and his incredible character and virtue. And so, yes, and God honors that. And so he has acted as the Redeemer, and therefore his name is connected with Elimelech's name, because they are second cousins, if you will, for lack of a better way to put it in our terminology. And so you have this story which is wrapped up in significant events that happen in the future. The story of Ruth started with three funerals: Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion. It ends with a wedding and three blessings: Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz. See, not all Cinderella stories are fantasy. Sometimes they actually happen. So let me give you two concluding thoughts. Your outline might have three. Once I rethought this, I came up with two. So you can add the third. Number one. Actually, I probably should read the last few verses. These are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron, to Hezron was born Ram, to Ram Abinadab, to Abinadab the son Nashon, to Nashon Salmon, to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse David. So the writer wants us to understand that there's an ongoing saga of what's happening. It's not an isolated event. And you could say the same thing about the book of Judges, because it ends with every man did what was right in his own eyes. So there's an ongoing saga. If that's where they were, that continues until there's a change. And part of what's changing during the time of the judges is that there are men and women of integrity. There are men and women who are following God. There are men and women who are being faithful. And Ruth and Boaz and Naomi become examples of those. And their saga continues. The story goes on because God is always at work, even in the midst of the most difficult of times. And this book of Ruth, reveals that God will use what you and I would consider to be unpromising material to bring blessing to others when these folks decide to trust and obey. Ruth was a Moabitess. She was a childless widow. She was poor. She became a true Israelite. She became a follower of God. She became a wife and a mother, and she became physically and spiritually rich. Why? Because she committed herself to God. Your people shall be my people. Your God shall be my God. I'll go where you go. And she followed through on that commitment. And not only did Ruth enjoy God's blessing personally, she then becomes a channel of blessing to all those around her, and ultimately to generations to come. As such, she becomes a paradigm of what God intended for the whole nation of Israel. He blessed them, why? So that they could be a blessing to the nations. The story of Ruth reveals the heart of the grace of God to bless so that our blessings could bless others. Secondly, there's an incredible amount of wickedness that takes place in the dark ages of the judges. But the book of Ruth reminds us that God's covenant promises are assured by the fact that he always preserves a remnant through which he will bring about his purposes and his promises. And Ruth and Boaz are a significant part of that remnant, because the remnant assures the preservation of the messianic line. In reality, there's nothing special about Boaz and Ruth, unless you say they're following God, makes them special. But they were ordinary people. They're doing ordinary things in the everyday things of life. They're living life. They're making decisions, just like you and I do. And the sovereign God was at work in their ordinariness of life, in their daily decisions, just like, because it's the same God who's at work in our daily lives. Because if Ruth is a Cinderella story, it could also be said, in one sense of the word, we're all Cinderella stories. Because we were lost, we were dirty, we were slaves, until the Prince of Peace found us and fit us for heaven. Or as C.S. Lewis says, he took daughters of Eve and sons of Adam and made them into kings and queens. You've got to read the Chronicles of Narnia. Come on, don't tell me you haven't read those yet. And then when he does that, we become joint heirs with the Son of God himself, with Jesus Christ. This story of Ruth points forward to David. David points forward to Jesus. Jesus points forward to the resurrection of our mortal bodies, where John the Apostle says, where death will be no more, neither shall be there mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. See, there's an ongoing history. We're involved in God's cosmic scheme, if you will. We're part of what God is doing. And the things that we do in our normal everyday lives, while we don't see it, are connected to what God is doing, the providential hand of God using our ordinary lives to accomplish his purposes. So let me conclude again with the quote from John Piper. The book of Ruth wants to teach us that God's purpose for the life of his people is to connect us to something far greater than ourselves. God wants us to know that when we follow him, our lives always mean more than we think they do. For the Christian, there's always a connection between the ordinary events of life and the stupendous work of God in history. Everything we do in obedience to God, no matter how small, is significant. It's part of a cosmic mosaic which God is painting to display the greatness of his power and wisdom to the world and to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. The deep satisfaction of the Christian life is that it is not given over to trifles. Serving a widowed mother-in-law, gleaning a field, falling in love, having a baby. For the Christian, these things are all connected to eternity. They're part of something so much bigger than they seem.